Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Tinuiti. This is the Friday show that reviews the most important media news stories of the week. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson. In today's show, is the metaverse even a good idea?
I see that as the role of the metaverse is for specialized situations. Yes, that kind of immersive technology will work.
Saying goodbye to primetime ads.
So there's a lot of people that actually like advertisements on social media in the sense that they feel like they're much more targeted and personal than ads that they used to see on TV.
How powerful are gaming influencers?
I think that people follow what they're interested in. And if you follow something you're interested in, you're more likely to participate. And so you're a stronger, stickier person to market to.
Dislike buttons get the thumbs down. The bestest. That's not a word. It might be. Working from somewhere advice ever. And a little known secret about the Statue of Liberty. All right, folks, joining me for this episode, we have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our principal analyst who heads up our retail practice. It's Susie David Canyon.
Hey, Marcus. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Susie. Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by our TV and video principal analyst who heads up our advertising and media practice. It's Paul Werner.
Great to be among the huddled masses.
Hey, chap. We're also joined by one of our senior forecasting analysts. You'll know him as Peter Varley.
Thanks for having me, Marcus.
Hey, buddy. So what do we have in store for you today? Well, there's four segments as per usual, but the things we're talking about will vary. We're going to start with talking about whether the metaverse is even a good idea. That's our story of the week. We move to the game of the week, where our contestants, Susie, Paul, and Peter, will go head-to-head-to-head, give us the best takeaway they can from each of the four stories we have for you, and win a championship belt. We then move on to working from somewhere. We talk about what it's like to work from somewhere. And then finally, dinner party data, where we talk some random trivia. Let's start with the story of the week. That's where we always begin. Is the metaverse a good idea? It's a fair question. The metaverse is being defined by Facebook, Microsoft and others as the virtual world that will usher in the next phase of the internet. In this world, we have digital versions of ourselves called avatars. Ethan Zuckerman, professor and director of the Initiative of Digital Infrastructure at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, recently wrote a piece in The Atlantic titled, "Hey Facebook, I made a metaverse 27 years ago. It was terrible then, and it's terrible now." So it got me wondering, is the metaverse even a good idea? According to one of Facebook's earliest investors, Roger McNamee, he doesn't think it's a good idea at all, saying that Facebook should not be allowed to create a dystopian metaverse. And the fact that we are all sitting and looking at this like it's normal should be alarming to everyone. So folks, we'll start with an opening question of, is the metaverse a horribly dystopian concept or the next step for the internet as a whole, not just Facebook?
I think the metaverse in and of itself is a great idea, right? If you think about retail and shopping, a place where people can come together, it's a social place where you can try things on without going to the store. Think about all the times retailers have blamed poor weather on bad sales. So in some ways, I think it's a great place and a nice next step from the internet. I don't think it'll replace the 2D internet. And I definitely think it's a bad idea when it comes to one singular company like ex-Facebook who appropriates a concept that has been in the works for years and makes it their own. And then it's especially bad when it's a company that is already having issues around privacy and misinformation and the sharing of news that is not great.
Okay, so happy to go down this path. A little bit nervous that Facebook is leading the charge, it sounds like. Peter, how about for you?
Yeah, I think a lot of the concerns that Susie mentioned are really valid, given that Facebook is starting to really talk about this and have obviously rebranded their entire company around this metaverse at the time when a lot of news is breaking, you know, from the Facebook files that were published and reported on by the Wall Street Journal. So the timing is not great. And, you know, a quote from the Atlantic article, the way that they end that is saying that Facebook's promised metaverse is about distracting us from the world it's helped to break. And I think that's sort of the core of why it's a little disturbing for a lot of people. Although the idea is really interesting, and we see companies like Microsoft start to use it in a way that a lot of people see as really productive when it comes to sort of workplace productivity and making virtual meetings a little more exciting and engaging. And as Susie mentioned, there's a lot of great retail opportunity. So there's a lot of positive things, but Facebook being at the helm of it at this moment in time is what makes it very dystopian.
Yeah, Yeah, to Peter's point, I want to quickly read a small passage from that because I thought it was really interesting. Professor Zuckerman ends his Atlantic article with Neil Stephenson's Metaverse. He's the chap who gets a lot of the credit for coining the term metaverse in his 1992 sci-fi piece. And he was influenced by other folks, but he gets a lot of the credit for starting the concept. It says, Neil Stephenson's metaverse has been a lasting creation because it's fictional. It doesn't have to solve all the intricate problems of content moderation and extremism and interpersonal interaction to raise questions about what virtual worlds can give us and what our real worlds lack. Today's metaverse creators are missing the point, just like I missed the point back when he tried to create one of these, Professor Zuckerman. The metaverse isn't about building perfect virtual escape hatches. It's about holding a mirror to our own broken shared world. Facebook's promised metaverse is about distracting us from the world it's helped break. Paul, where do you land?
Well, I very much agree with Susie and Peter on their concerns about Facebook appropriating this concept. I also agree that there is a place for this kind of technology or this kind of approach to technology, but I really don't see it going mainstream. And I keep thinking back to virtual worlds that we covered, Eddie Marketer, when I started back in 2007, Second Life at the time, which I think a lot of people probably don't even remember, was a big deal. And there was a lot of talk about individuals and brands getting into it. And they did actually get into it, but then it just completely fizzled out, went nowhere. I guess I also think about what's required to really take advantage of the metaverse, which is basically like a very large device wrapped around your head. And to me, that would be sort of like when Jacques Cousteau invented scuba diving back in the 1950s. If he had said, you know, this is the future of swimming from now on, like everybody's going to do this because you can experience so much more. Yes, you can. And a lot of people do. And there's a whole industry for, and, you know, scuba diving is great, but it doesn't replace swimming.
Most people
and
don't.
I see that as the role of the metaverse is, you know, for specialized situations. Yes, that kind of immersive technology will work. But in general, I just don't see every individual owning and using this large apparatus for all of the time they spend online.
Well, and I also think this is, we're talking about this so much because it's ex-Facebook, right? I think if it wasn't ex-Facebook, we wouldn't be spending so much time debating if the metaverse is the next thing. Like we read in the articles, it has been the next thing. It's been on the list for a long time and it's no better today, even though Facebook is trying, or ex-Facebook is trying to do it. It's just that we are talking about it more and there is a steep learning curve, not just from a consumer perspective, but also from the tech perspective, like Paul was just saying.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. You mentioned about it not being better today. I want to talk about that for a second because Meta, so as Facebook is now known, investing billions of dollars in this project. And I'm wondering whether they're wasting a lot of money. What if the world's not quite ready for the metaverse, the same way that the year of mobile was actually two decades? And Professor Zuckerman from the article notes that Mr. Zuckerberg is promising future technologies that are 5 to 10 years off. It still looks like junk, he says. The fire in his fireplace, talking about the demonstration that Mark Zuckerberg gave when they changed their name and basically showed people what their metaverse kind of looks like currently. He said the fire in Mark's fireplace was roughly rendered glow and his superhero secret lair looked like a lookout over a paradise island was almost entirely static. There's a nominal motion of waves, but none of the foliage moves. It's tropical wallpaper pasted to virtual windows. The sun is setting behind Mark Zuckerberg's left shoulder, but he's being lit from the right front. Even with a bajillion dollars to invest in a video to relaunch and rename his company, Mark's team is showing just how difficult it is to create a visually believable virtual world. Doesn't seem like it's ready yet, perhaps. My other question is, what if the future's AR? What if the future isn't VR? Well, of the future, to Paul's point, isn't everyone putting on a headset? And that's actually for specialized situations, but instead overlaying graphics, digital graphics onto the real world, whether that's looking through your phone, whether that's putting on some specialized pair of glasses for whatever reason, you know, not wearing them all day, perhaps maybe that's a bit excessive, but wearing them for certain situations, maybe for meetings, maybe whilst you're watching TV and the graphics get overlaid around your TV or on your coffee table. I'm still not sure that the future of the internet has to live inside the virtual reality headset.
Yeah, that was kind of the promise of like Google Glass and Snap, forget what they were called, like all of those products that, yeah, all of which I think were probably a little bit ahead of their time, but maybe more promising because they're less obtrusive. They also have to do a lot less, but to your point, Marcus, maybe that's all we need in terms of how we experience digital media. I don't know if everything has to be fully immersive
right
in the way that the metaverse is being positioned right now.
Right. So they were the snap spectacles, I should mention.
The one interesting thing I heard recently from Scott Galloway, who's sort of a marketing thought leader, was that he actually thinks that Apple's AirPods will be the start of the metaverse revolution, another thing that's less obtrusive and something that you can interact with and get feedback around your surroundings. So that was another interesting thing, maybe, you know, because those already have high adoption, unlike some of the glasses that were just mentioned.
Yeah.
Just a matter of sort of how it fits into the definition of what we're calling the metaverse.
Yeah. Let's end by talking about Joanna Stern of the Wall Street Journal. She recently wrote a piece and starred in a video called "I Spent 24 Hours in the Metaverse. I Made Friends, Did Work, and Panicked About the Future." And Ms. Stern, in this video, she wears the headset for 24 hours. She moves into a hotel for 24 hours, so gets away from her kids and her family and really immerses herself in this. So she's in this hotel. She says that the rules were she only took the headset off to eat, sleep, and use the restroom. Inside the VR headset, she plays games, tries to make friends, and even gets invited to a comedy club. She wakes up to reading the news inside the headset. She puts it on again after falling asleep. She doesn't wear it while she's sleeping. Eating a real yogurt at Machu Picchu. She has a workout inside Supernatural and attends her work meetings in Spatial and Horizon Workrooms. These are different apps. What did she learn, she says, aside from recommending that no one ever do this? Number one, tech companies are rushing into the metaverse to build the underlying platform. Number two, privacy tools and moderation will be tricky. And number three, headsets need to be smaller, more comfortable, and run longer on the charge. The point that jumped out to me, though, was the privacy and the moderation. Professor Zuckerman writes in his piece in The Atlantic, how will a company like Facebook that can only block 6% of Arabic language hate content deal with the dangerous speech when it's worn on an avatar's t-shirt or revealed at the end of a virtual fireworks display? Lots to figure out here. That's all we've got time for the story of the week. Time now for the game of the week. First, quick word from our sponsor, Tinuiti. Media is no longer a mass reach vehicle. Fragmentation is an understatement. Media is now about connecting with people in a personalized way, in a way that reflects their data privacy. Rethink media, rethink performance with Tinuiti, the largest independent performance marketing firm across streaming TV in the triopoly of Google, Facebook, and Amazon. Find out how at rethinkperformance.com. All right, we're back. It's time now for the game of the week. Today's game, What's the Point? Well, we read out four stories and have our contestants, Paul, Susie, and Peter, tell us what they think is the main takeaway of the story. Okay answers will get you 1 point. Good answers will get you 2. And unforgivably wonderful answers will get you 3 points. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this noise. Whoever has the most points after four rounds wins gets the last word. We start with Peter. Say goodbye to prime time advertising and say hello to integrated experiences. The advent of cable fragmented the audience and gave rise to the saying, there's 500 channels and nothing on, writes Jean-Paul J.P. Colico, president of ad sales at Warner Media in Adweek. With streaming and social media, he thinks that cliche may have evolved to everything is on, and I don't know where to find it. Mr. Colico says that audience and content are the two key parts of an effective marketing plan, and the connecting point for the consumer and advertiser comes down to intellectual property, or IP. IP connects with fans, he says. Listing Warner Media IP, obviously, because he works there, like DC Comics or Harry Potter, Mr. Colico notes that fans will find and follow that content wherever it is, and that consumers accept the value add the advertising offers and feel better about those brands that subsidize their favorite content. Therefore, brands have an opportunity to capture that fandom. Peter, saying goodbye to primetime advertising and hello to integrated experiences, what's the point?
So there's a lot of people that actually like advertisements on social media in the sense that they feel like they're much more targeted and personal than ads that they used to see on TV. You know, if you're watching cable and you're seeing ads that are trying to appeal to your whole family and, you know, everyone under the sun. So people like the more personal targeted ads, even though, you know, a lot of people also don't. But with this, tying ads to IP and some of the more on-demand content is sort of a shift more towards the very personalized advertisements, which, you know, are a little bit more appreciated by viewers. I think that it's really interesting to look at it that way and actually see this as a benefit from the viewer side.
Paul.
Well, In the same way that viewing has fragmented across different platforms and devices and time zones, or not time zones, but, you know, basically people being able to time shift viewing any way they want. The same is happening with advertising, of course, where really the idea of prime time harkens back to that appointment viewing that just almost doesn't even happen anymore. So, yeah, I think advertisers have to adopt this whole new mindset. I mean, they have been, but I think increasingly so. And the number of times where that kind of prime time advertising is going to be relevant are going to keep shrinking.
Susie.
So I'm going to take a slightly different shift in that. I didn't even understand what the title meant compared to the content of the actual article. There was nothing really around integrated advertising and marketing within the content. And what I find really sad is we spend so much time talking about marketing, but at the crux of marketing is understanding who your audience is and delivering a message that is brand right to your brand and that they want to watch, enjoy, and hopefully delight them in a way that they're going to remember and then go and try your product. And so nothing has changed. Maybe the context is a little bit different because if you're on social media, maybe you don't know what's around your ad. And so you have to be a little bit more careful about where you place your ad. But I don't know that that much has changed for the marketer from a content perspective.
Everyone gets a yellow card. Paul, Peter, Susie. Three issued for running long, but good answers. Round two. How powerful are gaming influencers? We start with Paul. 43% of the global population across 17 countries follow a social media influencer of any type, according to YouGov. On the high end, 75% of folks do in countries like the UAE. On the lower end, 29% of folks follow a social media influencer in the US, 22% in the UK. Food, health, and celebrity influencers have the highest following globally, 12% or more, whereas just 9% of folks worldwide follow gaming influencers. Paul, how powerful are gaming influencers? What's the point?
Well, I think they're more powerful than that last statistic you just cited would indicate. First off, there might be fewer people who follow gaming influencers, but those influencers do have a lot of sway over their audiences, probably more so than in other areas. The other thing is that when you segment it by demographic, men 18 to 24 definitely follow a lot more gaming influencers than do other age groups. So if that's your target audience, then that's a great way to reach them.
Susie.
I think that people follow what they're interested in. And if you follow something you're interested in, you're more likely to participate. And so you're a stronger, stickier person to market to.
Peter.
The thing that really stands out to me is getting back to what Paul said, where there's a very heavy skew towards 18 to 24 year old males. And that skew has persisted now for a pretty long time. And there's tons of reports that love to say that, you know, that's changing, but the data kind of shows time and time again, this shift is happening very, very slowly.
One of the things that jumped out to me in Q3 2019, before the pandemic, over 4 million channels on Twitch broadcast live content. 18 months later, that number had nearly tripled, reaching over 11 million channels, according to Stream Hatchet. So a lot more content to gobble up for those gaming viewers. Round three, what is everyone doing on their second screens? 84% of US adults are splitting their attention between TV and another device. That's consumer analytics firm Engine Insights. A write-up in a recent Adweek article by Eva Keese notes that millennials are most likely to be using second screen. 94% of Gen Z people do. Boomers, it's 71%. By gender, women are more likely to be second screening, 89% versus 80% for men. The second screen of choice for most folks is the smartphone, 70%, the computer, 16%, way behind, in second, and 12% for the tablet. What are people most likely to be doing on the second screen? Email, social media, then texting. And they're most likely to be watching reality TV, talk shows, game shows, or sports. Least likely to be watching comedy, sci-fi, drama, or crime. Susie, what is everyone doing on their second screens? What's the point?
So I think this is one of those where if you're doing mindless TV watching, you're doing something else. And this is, I think, what's more frightening for marketers because they can't engage with you if it's you're on email checking your work email or if you're texting. Social media is different. And so as a marketer, you are not just worried about where they're being entertained in terms of what channel or what live stream program they're watching or whatever platform they're on in terms of entertainment, but you also have to contend with a lot of other clutter.
Peter.
Yeah, in my opinion, the only nice thing about ads during TV is that you get 30 or 60 seconds to check your phone or do something else. The other thing that stood out to me is that is actually the least important to pay attention to in terms of following plot or storyline. So I was surprised to see that that is the least likely for people to multitask while watching.
Paul.
I'm sorry, were you talking to me? I was in the metaverse on my other screen here.
Typical.
You know, marketers are having a hard enough time with identity resolution, which is basically figuring out which device belongs to which person. But then when you layer over that, the fact that a lot of people are on multiple devices while they're being targeted by ads just makes it even that much more complicated.
Our numbers show that 74% of Americans use two or more devices to consume media at the same time. So similar to the number that we cited, 84% of US adults splitting their attention between TV and another device. Our numbers from Insider Intelligence suggest it's 74% of Americans. So still a lot of people. We move to our final round. Ooh. We'll start with Peter. Dislike buttons get the thumbs down. Writes Sarah Fisher and Ashley Gold of Axios. Likes or reactions have made tech platforms stickier, they note, which is good for selling ads. But tech companies are under pressure to address issues like user well-being, since engagement with like or dislike buttons impacts how content is promoted to users via algorithms. So public like and dislike counts are slowly disappearing. YouTube is the latest to recently phase them out, making dislike counts invisible to users, but still letting creators see them behind the scenes. A recent experiment by YouTube found that people were less likely to harass users by intentionally disliking videos when the counts were invisible, and that the dislike button was used to disproportionately target smaller channels and newer creators. Peter, dislike buttons getting the thumbs down. What's the point?
I'm always shocked when I'm watching an enjoyable, harmless video on YouTube and I see it has thousands and thousands of thumbs down. That being said, I never look to the like or dislike ratio to decide what I'm going to watch or stop watching something. So I don't think that this move will have much of a negative impact on users or creators, but I do think having the likes and dislikes available to be seen by the creators is a useful analytic.
Yeah, when you do see them, you're always like, Who would thumbs down this? And then when you don't see one, you're like, hang on a second, this is suspicious. Why isn't there at least one? Paul, what you got?
Well, I mean, if this leads to any curtailment in harassment, it's a step in the right direction. It's probably a step in the right direction regardless. But I also think it's cosmetic, and all of the things that are bad or dangerous about YouTube are not going to change as a result of this. But, you know, as long as people who want to see it, or, you know, as long as creators can still see it if they want to, I think it's probably best that they not be public.
Susie.
See, this is the part I don't understand. If it's all about mental health and well-being, then having access to it as a creator on the back end still causes you that same anxiety if you have many more dislikes than likes. So I get it from a YouTube perspective why we're doing it, but then where does that stop? Are we going to stop doing the 5-star ratings for restaurants because we don't want to hurt the feeling of the cook or the chef or the owner? What about products that you're buying on Amazon? Where do we stop? And if we are going to do it because it is the right thing to do from a harassment perspective, then don't show me the numbers on the back end.
Facebook and Instagram started offering the option to hide public like counts earlier this year, and the Axios article noted that in rebranding to Meta, Facebook ditched its thumbs up logo for the abstract infinity loop. That's what we've got time for the game of the week. This week's winner, I'll take a drum roll for as long as possible. Susie is this week's winner of the game of the week.
That's
what?
Not fair.
No.
I'm not accepting it.
Why was it a give me?
Because you got the pressure.
I did. Okay. Stuart, who runs the team for Content Studio, he did threaten to launch a social media campaign with a hashtag Susie for the win. However, that aside, you had some good answers. Contending with clutter on round three. And then I realized your points about the dislike button. And where does it stop? Where does it end?
I think you were the rightful
winner.
So
congratulations. You won.
Sure.
It's legitimate.
Oh my gosh. I don't even know what to do because now I'm not going to be able to lobby for winning a trophy. So I don't know that I want I don't want it.
Unbelievable. This whole time. For listeners who haven't listened to it before, for months, Susie has been complaining that she never wins. She is highly competitive. And now she's won. She doesn't even bloody want the trophy.
No, I just got a participation ribbon. That's really basically what happened.
We didn't give her one of those. That didn't happen. Susie, you won. You don't get a choice. What do you want to tell the people with your 30 seconds of fame?
Well, that's the problem. I was not ready for this, and I did not play Roblox.
I wasn't
with my
ready
nephew.
For this.
I think I'm just going to plug that it's coming to the end of the year, and a lot of our coverage areas are doing these amazing trend reports, and there are so many interesting things coming out, and I think you should all keep an eye out for that.
Very nice. Yep, the trend reports look into the future, and it's what our analysts think you should be paying attention to for 2022. We're going to be covering a number of them, a number of the trends on this podcast, trends for 2022 in the different categories. Also coming out, we have our eight most specific, uniquely specific or unnervingly specific trends for next year. We did that last year. We're going to be doing that again. We'll get some very specific trends as well, which probably won't happen. But stay tuned for that, or check out some of them already publishing on Pro, insiderintelligence.com. That's all we've got time for the Game of the Week. It's time now for Working From Somewhere. All right, folks, this is the segment where we talk about working from somewhere. And today, I decided that I would just let the folks on the episode give out a little bit of advice. The bestest work from somewhere advice ever. So we talk a lot about this. They're doing it themselves to varying degrees, whether that's complete remote, hybrid. No one's going into the office full time, so that's not a thing, at least for the folks on this show, but maybe going in more than they used to, perhaps. So they're living it like a lot of you folks are living it who are listening to this show. So I thought we might as well ask them what they think, since they've been experiencing it themselves. So folks, the bestest, well, stop saying that word. I don't think I'm using it correctly. Work from somewhere advice ever. Susie, do you want to start since you won? What you got for us?
Sure. I'm a little bit embarrassed because my bestest tip didn't actually work today. It's to get a cable for your internet Wi-Fi so that when you're home and your Wi-Fi is down, that you don't feel stressed about it in big meetings. You just plug in your cable. However, that did not happen today. And for whatever reason, my cable did not work and I had internet issues.
Took us 2 hours to get this recording going.
Literally. Yeah. Literally, it was the worst experience of my life. I felt very stressed that everybody was waiting for me. So you got to figure out how to use the cable properly. It's, of course, this week is the first week it hasn't worked. But that would have been my best tip ever.
Ethernet cable. Yeah. Good shout. Peter.
I have two, and they're pretty straightforward. First one is I like eating lunch away from my desk, so away from the screens.
Anywhere in particular?
About 5 feet that way. So I don't travel very far, but it's enough to make a difference. And it's just a nice way to break up the day, even if it's only 10 or 15 minutes.
Very nice.
And number two is if you drink coffee, invest in a good coffee machine so you don't have to go out and get coffee every single day and pay.
I thought you were going to say, so you don't have to drink instant coffee.
But Peter, did you know that Marcus drinks instant coffee? I mean, I might too sometimes.
A lot of people drink. You know, yeah, exactly. Susie was getting on me today about it and then was like, oh, by the way, I do it as well.
I didn't know that. And it's
since
probably
the pandemic.
Probably something he didn't feel comfortable sharing.
He probably did it before the pandemic.
We've shared
too,
it. We've shared it for him many, many times.
Yeah, exactly. Other people have shared that happily. Thanks.
Marcus, you have a lot of loyal listeners. I'm sorry that, you know, they're going
to. I used to until they found out that I drank.
No, they heard last week. This is not my secret to give. The bigger secret is how Marcus drinks tea, but I'm not going to divulge that information.
Let's keep that quiet. Yeah, the numbers plunged. The episode that we reviewed revealed that I drank instant coffee. Fell off a cliff. Very good. Paul, what you got for us?
Yeah, I also have two. One is invest in the best possible internet connection you can get. You would be amazed at how many problems that you wouldn't even think it solves. It does. And yes, wired internet is almost always faster than Wi-Fi. But even if you just get the fastest possible option at whatever cost, it's worth it. And the other thing is that even if you believe that we will all be back working in offices sometime soon, the world that we're in now is going to continue in one form or another. So accept the fact that this is going to be a reality. So maybe you go back to working full time in the office, but there are going to be times when you work at home. And when you do work at home, you're going to be expected to rise to a higher standard technology-wise, and your internet connection and associated equipment will only help with that.
Yeah.
I feel like that was a dig for me. Indirectly.
Definitely
not at
100%
all.
Directly. That was a direct hit.
Because things, you know, Susie, you've actually made the investments, but they happen to fail as, today, as they often do. So it's not a question of like, you know.
That's very kind of you. Yeah. You guys, I had a second one too. I just thought we were doing one at a time. My second one, because I've tried all the ones that I can't give the advice because I can't follow, like have a routine, go for a walk, go out and get a coffee. Like none of that has worked for me. But what has worked is make plans with friends more regularly after work earlier. Mm. I used to do that when I went to the office too back in the day, because that forces you to stop whatever you're, there's always that next project, that next email, that next something. So if you have plans, then you got to go.
Very nice. Very nice. That's a good one. All right, I got two for you real quick. Number one, break your 8 hours into 8 singular hours and treat it more like you've got kind of 8 blocks of time that you've got to fill. And then to what Peter was saying kind of about lunch, think about where you should work based on the activity. Not everyone can do this. Some people are like, Marcus, I have 12 kids. Are you out of your mind? But for some people, they can. I mean, even if you have kids, I would still recommend, you know, breaking it up into blocks, thinking about where you need to take meetings, where you can get some work done offline, where you do need the internet perhaps, and just breaking it up. So maybe you spend the morning at the breakfast bar, you know, for a few hours. Maybe you go to your desk for another few hours for the rest of the morning. Maybe you spend the afternoon in the garden, you know, reading from your laptop, because you don't need to have internet for the task you're doing. Not every task is internet related. A lot of them are. Or maybe you go to a coffee shop or something like that where it can be a bit noisier, but just treating it like you've got 8 blocks of time and breaking it up. Maybe you put in the middle of the day an hour's lunch with a friend, and you know, you spend an extra hour at the end of the day doing a bit more work. I've found personally, at least, that's worked really well for me. And then the second thing is take lots of breaks. So we mentioned this on an episode and I actually tried it out. It works so well. According to the time tracking app Desk Time, the most productive people work for 52 minutes and then take a 17-minute break. That may seem insane and completely unachievable, but it really does work. So take a break, a real break, not doing chores, but call someone, read something, watch something, go for a walk, make a drink, play with the kids. And when you come back, you feel just remarkably energized. So they're my two.
Marcus, what happened with your experiment of not having the webcam on?
Oh, yeah. Good question. So I was doing that for folks listening who have no idea what we're talking about. There was a study from last year, two psychologists had worked on last summer, 2020, looking at what it was like to have the cameras switched off when you're doing video chat. And they found that it improved people's well-being quite significantly. And so I tried it for a week, went off video for a week, but still attended meetings just audio-wise. And yeah, you stop staring at yourself, which feels really nice. And I did feel like maybe I was tuning in a bit more to the meetings because I'm not spending the whole time staring at my background or the horrible choice of clothes that I decided to pick for myself today, or just how horrendous I look. So yeah, I don't know if it drastically improved my well-being, but it did feel nice to not have to have that kind of pressure. And then also for some meetings, you can just listen to them. And yeah, sure, when you're doing other stuff, you can be distracted, but sometimes you're not. And sometimes you can do other things, especially in big meetings, and, you know, maybe go make a coffee, get some water, you know, go for a just walk around the living room or something to kind of stretch, as opposed to having to sit and pretend like you're paying all the attention in the world when you don't need to be the whole way through the meeting. So I did think that was a beneficial.
The final thing I'll say is that you can also, if you click on the window that has your face in it, whether it's on Zoom or Google Meet or whatever, you can either hide yourself entirely so that you don't have to look at yourself, but other people can see you. So it looks like you're talking to a YouTube video because the person you're talking to, their face appears on the screen, but there's no window for you, even though they can still see you. Or you can just minimize, I think it's unpin your face. And so by doing that, you reduce the size of the window that you're in and it becomes a small window in the bottom corner of the screen. And the bigger windows are then just for the people you're talking to, which I found is actually quite nice because you can still see yourself, but you're not so focused on yourself because you're a tiny window as opposed to everyone else who's a larger window and you can see them.
I find that when my video is on, I have this urge to give myself a thumbs down. So if they take away that button, then I'm really screwed here. I'm not going to be able to do it.
Well, I was kind of thinking the same. Like I wouldn't, like without the video, then I don't have to sneak my phone usage, right? I can just do it right in front of the camera and nobody would be the wiser.
It depends. Yeah. Well, Susie, it depends what you're doing when the camera's off. If you're paying no attention at all, that's an issue. But if you're doing something else, you know, like making a drink or just walking around, you know, then
ooh,
that's
making
okay.
A drink.
Susie's not to be, anyone listening who works for Susie, she is not to be trusted if the camera's off, okay? She's not working at all. That's what we've got time for working from somewhere. It's time now for Dinner Party Data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. We start with Susie because she won. A surprise to everyone. I'm kidding, but it was actually quite shocking.
It was so shocking I had to text Blake. Well, I am Blake, on Slack and say like, oh my God, guess what just happened? The biggest news of this century. I did tell him it was a participation ribbon though. It's clear. It is very clear.
I mean, kind of. Blake, for people listening in who don't, most people should know Blake, but he's on the show every week. We gave him a week off.
I'm sad that I won on a week that he was not here, though. So I'm going to have to just keep lobbying to win. But anyways, my dinner party data is with Thanksgiving right around the corner. Mm-hmm. As you all know, I'm Canadian and fascinated by our monarchy and the habits of those in the UK. So I was wondering, do the British celebrate Thanksgiving? And it turns out they do not. They celebrate something called the Harvest Festival in late September or early October that is celebrated in a church, usually with Marcus is nodding, so I think he is very well aware of the Harvest Festival. Do you want to tell us, as a person who's participated in it, what it's like?
I did it a few times as a kid when I was really young. And yes, you go into a church and you often sing songs or hymns. A lot of it centered around, donating food. So everyone would bring in food and that food goes to charity. A lot of times it's like canned goods that you would then send on to charity. But yeah, I kind of remember being told about this. So Harvest Festival, it's really old. The Harvest Festival tradition, it predates Christianity and it comes from an old English word, which I can't pronounce, but it's kind of spelt like...
Horky or something like this?
Harfest?
Oh, I don't know.
But maybe you have a different word. It basically means autumn or fall. But yes, there's some religious associations to it now,
Pagan,
but by and large,
religious.
Well, it used to be, but then the church adopted it. Yeah.
Yes.
And so now, you sing songs in a church and donate food. And there's a lot of countries that have it.
There's a procession, there's supper, it's like a big deal, there's dancing and music, and there are corn dolls that I guess dress tables, maybe this is from the pagan times, and that kept till the spring so that you can make sure that the gods that be that celebrate harvesting come back to you and are kind. So this brings us to the US and Thanksgiving, which is coming up. Do you guys know what, according to Instacart, they did an October survey or facilitated a survey in October. Do you know what percentage of the US population eats a pie at Thanksgiving?
Everyone, 100,000%.
99.9.
So close.
Oh, it's taking the under.
94%. And can you guys guess which one is the most popular flavor?
Pecan.
Apple.
Pumpkin.
Pumpkin it is for the win. 31%.
Of course it's pumpkin.
Said Paul. Pumpkin. 18% said apple and also 18% said pecan.
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 Ah, man.
And that is my data for you.
Very nice. So, two things quickly. One, if you go to England and you're looking for a Harvest Festival celebration, you won't find it. Like, no one does it anymore. You might, if you go to school and you're like 9 or 8 years old and you have to participate, then you will. But by and large, some religious people, I guess, like at churches, it might be a thing, but most people won't know about it. They do have it in Australia and Sweden and India and other places, so you can find it there maybe. But I was reading about Thanksgiving. Apparently, America, we gave it to you. Early English settlers took the idea of Harvest Thanksgiving to North America, with First Thanksgiving, which was celebrated by the religious refugees from England known as Pilgrims in 1621. They invited Native Americans to a harvest feast at the Plymouth Plantation to celebrate a successful crop, and turkey wasn't a thing. It was a thing, but they didn't eat it. They had goose, lobster, fish, and deer. Lobster! Very fancy. But yeah, we don't have it because we have the Harvest Festival, but we also have a Sunday roast. So every Sunday, every Sunday, you have the option of eating what is basically a Thanksgiving dinner from your local pub. So you go to the pub, Thanksgiving dinner is there. It's just called a Sunday roast. So we cheat and we have it every single week. It's amazing. Who's next? Who do we have? Has anyone else gone? I forget. Paul? Paul's up.
Yeah. So 500 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every minute. So that's a time multiple of 30,000. That means for every minute of real time, 30,000 minutes of video are uploaded to YouTube. Now, we did a report in June of 2018 called Policing Video Content on YouTube. This was in the aftermath. Actually, Policing Video Content on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. This was in the aftermath of Cambridge Analytica and a lot of concern around brand suitability on YouTube. There have been all sorts of problems. So at that time, the multiple was 2,400. So now it's 30,000. So even in just those last 3+ years, the scale has increased.
Wow.
Quite dramatically. Another related stat, so that the one I just cited was about the amount of time that's uploaded to YouTube, but the amount of time that's spent watching videos is 3.25 billion hours per month. So I did some math, and if you took all of the videos that are watched on YouTube in a single day and you strung them together end to end, anyone want to guess how long it would take you to watch those videos?
Forever. Infinity time.
Not quite, but I think for the purposes of most of us in our lifetimes, yes, because the number is 1,236,682 years.
Wow.
So 1.25 million years it would take to watch all of the videos that are watched on YouTube in any single day. So these stats, to me, like, I can't even wrap my mind around these numbers, but
no.
You know, this is not to excuse YouTube or any platform for all the stuff that happens that we talk about all the time, but it does give you an idea of just the scale of the platforms when you're talking about that many users and that much content. It's just mind-boggling how you even control that.
Yeah, it's frightening. Peter, what you got for us?
So I'm extremely excited about the most expensive TV show of all time. And do you guys know what it is by chance?
Game of Thrones.
Bachelor?
It's coming out. It's coming out relatively soon.
Yeah, it's totally Bachelor.
One that I'm less excited about, but I'm sure expensive.
Is it Game of Thrones?
It's not, but it's in the realm of fantasy. So the budget of the first season of the Lord of the Rings prequel show is estimated to be around $465 million.
Wait, you said TV show?
It's going to be a
show. Wait, so multi-episode?
Yes. It's going to be a show, series that is going to run anywhere from, you know, maybe 3 to 5 seasons. So $465 million is the budget for the first season. So that means if there are 10 episodes, that's roughly $47 million per episode. And that would make it just by far the most expensive season of a show ever produced.
Does that include salaries? Do you know?
I don't know. This is actually coming from what Stuart Nash, the New Zealand Minister for Economic Development and Tourism, said. That's the price that he gave for how much Amazon is spending.
Yeah, Stuart, you can trust him.
Yeah, I can trust him because they're filming a lot in New Zealand, which is why he's the one saying that. They're doing a lot of the filming there.
It better be really, 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 really good.
And just for a little bit of context, IndieWire. I'm getting these numbers from IndieWire, but the original Lord of the Rings trilogy cost about $280 million to make. The Hobbit trilogy, $623 million to make. And the Game of Thrones final season was only around $90 million. So if you're comparing the Game of Thrones final season to the first season of Lord of the Rings, it's about 5 times as expensive.
Wow.
But for Jeff Bezos, it's pocket change.
I'm telling you.
Yeah. Wait, what is that compared to like Friends? Remember when that was like a big deal that it was so expensive? But it was mostly the salaries, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the one location. Cheeky.
Yeah.
very good. All right, 2 quick ones for you. Number 1, malls and casinos fool us with the Gruen transfer. So one thing that malls and casinos have in common, aside from the crowds and spending, is that there are barely any clocks or windows. To the people inside, this creates a scripted disorientation called the Gruen transfer that makes them lose track of time. How is that not illegal? It's like subliminal messaging, which has been illegal since 58. How is the Gruen transfer not something that should be illegal? No?
Good luck getting out of a casino, too.
I lived in one for 2 years.
A lot of department stores, like, you know, trying to find, I mean, yes, they have emergency exits, but if it's not an emergency, good luck finding your way out a lot of times.
And there's no service. There's no cell service in a casino. Can't even call for help.
It's very
very true. Second one for you. The Statue of Liberty. Wondering if Victoria knows this. Although Paul is also New Jersey kid. Everyone's New Jersey kid who works at the company. It's crazy. The Statue of Liberty is not in New York. She does know.
This
the Statue
is a,
of Liberty.
This is a very complicated issue.
Which adorns pretty much every bit of tourist memorabilia that you can purchase in the Big Apple is actually not located in New York at all. It's technically in New Jersey. Broke my heart to find that out. She's a Jersey girl, says Victoria.
You also have to go, by the way, if you want to see a home game by the New York Giants, you have to go to New Jersey as well.
And the Jets. What sham? What is in New York anymore? The Giants don't play there. The Jets don't play there.
The Jets don't play there either, I should have mentioned. Yeah.
The Yankees, basically Lake George, by the time you get to Yankee Stadium. What's happening? New York. Very upset with you. Anyway, so we've got time for today's episode. Thank you so much to everyone for hanging out. Thank you to Paul.
Thanks for having me.
We thank Peter.
Thank you.
We thank Susie, the winner of the game of
Woo-hoo!
The week.
I can't even believe it. Thanks so much.
Yes. Congratulations. That was to you. I was going to say congratulations to Victoria. It's probably more appropriate that I say thanks to Victoria. She edits the show, but congratulations as well, Victoria. Thanks to everyone listening. To ask us congratulations on having the Statue of Liberty in your backyard and lending it to the New York people who claim her as their own. She's not. To ask questions, just say hi. You can email us at podcast@emarketer.com. This coming Monday, November 22nd, check out our Industry Voices Spotlight on Financial Services with M&T Bank. We'll see you guys hopefully on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily and eMarketer podcast made possible by Tinuiti. Happy weekends.
I'm going to have to go open a bottle of champagne now.
Oh, a bottle of champagne. Very nice.